wasn't cluster bombs and so on and so forth. The attack on the Nord Stream pipeline, which was clearly carried out by the U.S. and or allies, and the blowing up of the dam, the Kukovo dam, the threats against the Zaporizhzhia nuclear plant. Where's the escalation going to stop? So I totally agree that we need an outpouring of opposition to the war. It's hurting people worldwide and endangering, you know, the entire world.
Okay. Chris, if you have 1 minute.
Yeah, we have a very, very bad perspective. In fact, our governments fight against their own people. They keep their opposition divided, espionaged upon. They keep them under pressure, under illegal pressure. So the whole judicial apparatus is being misused to oppress the opposition in Western countries, in Germany, of course, as well. Our little party, what happens to us is crazy. So we have a situation where the European people have no means left to liberate themselves. All these rulers are externally and internally going forward illegally, and that is a very, very bad situation. And I don't see any close positive viewpoint on this, and I am very much fearing escalation.
Okay, thank you so much for that. Christoph Forsell in Berlin, Germany, Rick Sterling in Walnut Creek, California.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. Here we enlighten you with ayahs 36 through 38 from the Surah Nahl, recited by Qasim Razi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Walaqad ba'athna fi kulli ummatin rasulan an i'budullaha wajtanibut taghut. فَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ هَدَى اللَّهُ وَمِنْهُمْ مَنْ حَقَّتْ عَلَيْهِ الضَّلَالَةِ فَسِيرُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ فَانْظُرُوا كَيْفَ كَانَ عَالِمًا فاحرص على هداهم فإن الله لا يهدي من يضل وما لهم من ناصرين وأقسموا بالله جهد أيمانهم لا يبعث الله من يموت بلى وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون بلى وعدا عليه حقا ولكن أكثر الناس لا يعلمون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And certainly we raised in every nation an apostle, saying, serve Allah and shun the Satan. So there were some of them who Allah guided, and there were others against whom error was due. Therefore travel in the land, then see what was the end of the rejecters. If you desire further guidance, yet surely Allah does not.
The headlines, Iran's president is heading to Zimbabwe after visiting Kenya and Uganda. He says boosting ties with Africa is high on the agenda of Tehran's foreign policy. Russia says NATO's latest summit showed that the military alliance is returning to Cold War schemes and is unable to adapt to new geopolitical realities. And also in our headlines, North Korea says it has successfully tested a new intercontinental ballistic missile, calling the move a warning to the U.S. and other adversaries. Hello and welcome, everybody. Our top story for this half hour. President Ebrahim Raisi says expanding relations with African nations is high on the agenda of Iran's foreign policy as he's touring the continent. Raisi said Iran has developed good relations with African countries since the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. He made the remarks in a meeting with his Ugandan counterpart in the capital, Kampala. The Iranian president called for boosting bilateral ties in different levels. The two sides also inked four cooperation documents. Raisi began his three-day tour by visiting Kenya in the capital, Nairobi. Iran's president and his Kenyan counterpart highlighted the importance of boosting bilateral cooperation.
We have historic cooperation with the African continent and Kenya and believe that relations between the governments and people of Iran and Kenya can expand further. Our goal is to expand cooperation by tenfold.
I expressed our gratitude and commitment to expand and deepen these relations. President Raisi and I had the opportunity to engage views and share ideas about emerging opportunities to improve the balance of trade.
The Iranian and Kenyan presidents also signed a number of cooperation documents in various areas. Iran's president is heading to Zimbabwe after visiting Kenya and Uganda. This is the first visit to the continent by an Iranian president in over a decade. Our correspondent Gisumi Shahmadi says the health industry is one of the main areas Tehran wants to cooperate with African nations.
we're going to Zimbabwe, one of the most important issues on the agenda, as far as I have been able to find out, is the issue of cooperation in health. And Iran is planning to expand its cooperation in this regard with African countries. This is one of the strong points of Iran. Iran has been able not just to produce pharmaceuticals at a price that is much more affordable for Africans than what other countries are offering them, but also Iran is prepared to set up clinics. And therefore, in Zimbabwe, what we are expecting to happen is to see cooperation agreements signed in the field of health, and also health tourism is something that Iran is looking to.
Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has criticized Western countries for their colonial pursuit despite claiming to be liberal democracies. Ayatollah Khamenei called those democracies a big lie. He said that Western states are opposed to freedom-seeking and any democracy which is independent of the global arrogance. He said that a clear example of such a policy is Ukraine, where civilians are being killed because Western arms manufacturers seek their benefits from the continuation of war. Elsewhere in his remarks, Iran's leader said the U.S. pursues evil acts as it confronts other nations in all fields. He said that today the West is vulnerable more than ever. Ayatollah Khamenei also noted that the steadfastness of the Iranian nation and the Islamic establishment against what he called the Western Front is in fact a cultural and global fight. Glenn Deason, a professor of international relations at the University of Southeastern Norway, says the Western hegemony is coming to an end as the U.S. sees its global power declining rapidly.
Well, I think that is a reference to 500 years of hegemony coming to an end. It can be seen in many aspects. Many would put put this war as a key example that after 30 years of NATO expansion, which is a way for the U.S. to project its hegemony, we see this military balancing by the Russians, which is a challenge. But it's also, and I would argue, primarily in the economic sphere, which is why the U.S. is so hostile towards China, because under Chinese leadership, most of the world outside NATO is moving to other tech centers, new industries, transportation corridors. They're de-dollarizing, using their own currency, developing their own development banks, their own payment systems. So they see a whole economic system, effectively what underpins the U.S. hegemon. No dollar, there's no empire. So I think this is the weakest spot. And also this whole rules-based international order, which the U.S. has been promoting so heavily to replace to a large extent international law, because it gives certain prerogatives to the U.S. and its allies. So, for example, it can exempt itself from international law. So it can interfere in the domestic affairs of other countries. They can topple governments. You can invade. So all of this under the guise of liberal democracy. So you see a lot of the world now rejecting all of this. So there's a huge shift. But again, it's primarily economic, and you see it expressed politically. But of course, this war should also to some extent be understood as a rejection of this effort in Europe to develop U.S. hegemony at the expense of Russian security. So there's certainly a lot of truth to this. And I think this is also why the United States is quite anxious at the moment. Its security strategy is based on not accepting the emergence of any rivals which can challenge it. And it now sees its relative power in the world declining very rapidly. So there's a lot at stake in this conflict, which is why when tensions or relations are framed in this zero-sum, winner-takes-all format, we see that countries are willing to take much greater risks. And this is exactly what we're seeing now, as the world even risks a nuclear war.
Russia says the latest summit of NATO member states showed that the U.S. and Western military alliance is returning to Cold War schemes. The Russian Foreign Ministry said in a statement that the summit proved NATO's inability to adapt to the new geopolitical situation in the world. It added that the alliance is escalating political and military tensions as it continues to lower the threshold for the use of force. Russia also criticized NATO members' pledges to provide Ukraine with modern and long-range weapons, adding they only seek to prolong the conflict as long as possible. Moscow stressed that it will give a timely and appropriate response to all challenges and threats to its security and interests. The NATO summit in Lithuanian capital city of Vilnius ended with the U.S. and its allies giving Ukraine new security assurances in its war with Russia. Well, North Korea says it has successfully tested its new intercontinental ballistic missile, calling it a warning to the U.S. and other adversaries. Pyongyang said the missile launch was aimed at further developing the country's strategic nuclear force, slamming U.S. deployment of submarines and bombers to the Korean Peninsula. The North warned that the situation has reached the phase of nuclear crisis beyond the Cold War era. The North Korean leader oversaw the test. Kim Jong-un said Pyongyang will take increasingly strong measures to protect itself until the U.S. and its allies drop their hostile policies. The missile test prompted condemnations from the U.S., South Korea, and Japan. The U.N. Security Council is set to meet on Thursday to discuss the launch. Our correspondent Jennifer Chang joined us earlier from Seoul to tell us more about the capabilities of the latest ballistic missile launched by North Korea.
One thing that's clear is that this was a huge success for the North and a game changer. Kim Jong-un, the North Korean leader, said that he's going to make this Hwasong-18 the core of his nuclear strike capability. And this Hwasong-18 is road mobile. It can be fired off within minutes from any secret location in North Korea. It does not have to be fueled up for hours and hours like a liquid fuel ICBM. It was first test fired just 3 months ago in April. And experts are very surprised that the North is making such rapid headway in advancing its Hwasong-18 capabilities. This flew longer than the one fired in April. In fact, it flew longer than any North Korean ICBM that has been test fired in the past. It flew for over 74 minutes. The flight time is an indication of the missile's range, and it was fired at a lofted angle. It traveled about 1,000 kilometers with an altitude about 6,000 kilometers. And if this were fired on a standard trajectory, experts say this would fly over 15,000 kilometers and could hit any major U.S. city on the U.S. mainland. Once it leaves the ground, it would be virtually impossible to shoot down. The U.S. missile defense would be like trying to shoot down a bullet with a bullet. And now that it's solid fueled, the U.S. cannot intercept it before it leaves the ground with a spy satellite. But many experts say the only way out of this mess is for the U.S. to negotiate with North Korea. But the U.S. has said, along with South Korea and Japan, that they are going to strengthen their efforts to counter the North militarily and diplomatically.
The leader of the Lebanese resistance movement, Said Hassan Nasrallah, says Israel was behind the latest incident of the desecration of the holy Muslim book, the Quran, in Sweden. Nasrallah said the Israeli spy agency Mossad recruited a Christian Iraqi man to carry out the sacrilegious act with the aim of sowing sedition between Christians and Muslims. He urged people to be cautious about such Zionist plots. Nasrallah made the remarks during a speech on the 17th anniversary of the victory of Lebanon in a war waged by Israel. He described the victory as a significant chapter in the history of Lebanon. Nasrallah noted that the 33-day war failed to crush the resistance, adding, "The resistance continues to strengthen its deterrence power." He also touched on the recent Israeli large-scale attack on the occupied West Bank city of Jenin, saying the raid also failed because of the steadfastness and courage of Palestinians and resistance fighters. Well, it's been 17 years since Israel launched a full-scale war against Lebanon. The impacts of the Israeli act of aggression are still being discussed and analyzed. Mariam Saleh reports from Lebanon.
17 years have passed since Israel launched its biggest full-scale war against Lebanon, apart from the 1982 invasion. The Israeli Air Force bombarded the infrastructure of Lebanon, threw cluster munitions in most of southern Lebanon, and killed over 1,200 people. The town of Bint Ishbael witnessed some of the most fierce fighting during the 2006 war. This market was turned to rubble, yet that was a cost the people of Lebanon were ready to pay if it meant that Israel would be deterred from launching another act of aggression. The fighting here turned to hand-to-hand combat at times, and the Israelis were still incapable of dislodging Hezbollah, while resistance rockets increased.
Here in Bent Jebel suffered the most brutal assaults, artillery and air shelling. The Israelis use all types of weapons against us, but we were able to stay steadfast as long as our resistance was steadfast. Nothing could stop Israel except the resistance and its arms. And it's only the resistance that's protecting us, not the Security Council or human rights organizations.
When they could not crush the resistance, they began to commit massacres, trying to turn the people against the resistance. But people continued to support the resistance.
Strategy experts believe that before 2006, Hezbollah's main goal was a strategy of defense. Yet the fighting capabilities of the resistance has reached an extent where launching a preemptive war against the Israelis is plausible.
After the 2006 war, the resistance itself realized that it has capabilities beyond those of defense. They have reached the ability of initiating operations in enemy territory, as well as a necessary level of maneuver to launch an offensive. Hezbollah's Secretary General was therefore able to promise the fighters that one day they would be given a direct order to cross the border with occupied Palestine and fight on the land of the Galilee.
Israel's internal investigations into the July war proved that it was a failed mission for the regime. Yet Hezbollah's military presence remains intact and its popular support stronger than ever before. The 2006 July war gave birth to a new equilibrium in the conflict between Lebanon and Israel, and it proved that Hezbollah was not to be taken lightly. Israel's worst fear now is that any wrong move could find Hezbollah in the Galilee region. Maryam Saleh, Maruna Ras, South Lebanon.
The occupying regime of Israel has killed 206 Palestinians since the beginning of this year. That's according to the Palestine Data Center, Moti. The center said 64 Palestinians were killed in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin during that period, while 46 others were killed in Nablus. Israeli forces raids took their toll on other West Bank cities as well, killing a total of 29 Palestinians in Ramallah, Al-Khalil, and the occupied Al-Quds. 37 Palestinian citizens were also killed by Israeli forces in the besieged Gaza Strip. The regime has escalated its violence against Palestinians. Under its new far-right cabinet led by Benjamin Netanyahu, last week Israeli forces launched a major aerial and ground assault on the city of Jenin and its refugee camp. The offensive killed 12 Palestinians and injured around 120 others. Peru has extended a state of emergency along the country's main roadways for another month as a new round of protests is expected next week. The state of emergency suspends certain rights, including the freedom of movement. Peruvian Prime Minister Alberto Otarola says that it will help keep roads open ahead of the independence holiday. Peru was gripped by protests late last year after former President Pedro Castillo was ousted and detained after he tried to dissolve Congress and rule by decree. He remains jailed while his vice president, Dina Boluarte, serves as president. And that's a wrap for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
Human rights defenders have condemned the Zionist regime's planned West Bank settlement expansion. According to reports, the Netanyahu regime has informed the U.S. of plans to build thousands of new Jewish-only settler homes. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout noted, human rights defenders have recently blasted Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's far-right apartheid government after it reportedly informed the Biden administration of plans to build thousands of new Jewish-only settler homes in the illegally occupied West Bank of Palestine. Three Israeli regime and U.S. officials told Axios that Israel will announce later this month its intention to build at least 4,000 homes in existing West Bank settler colonies. Recently, the Zionist and international media reported that Netanyahu's government would postpone plans for what's known as E1 project due to U.S. pressure. For two decades, the Zionist regime and international human rights experts have called the settlements, which are illegal under Article 49 of the Fourth Geneva Convention and the International Criminal Court's Rome Statute, part of the Zionist regime's apartheid. The seizure of Palestinian land in the occupied territories is also a war crime under the Rome Statute. The Zionist regime's finance minister, Bezalel Smotrich, who opined in 2021 that all, not just most, Arabs should have been ethnically cleansed from Palestine at Israel's birth, said during a recent press conference that We will have big news for the settlements in the West Bank imminently. This is while the Biden administration has largely turned a blind eye to the Zionist settlement construction and expansion, but says it is strongly opposed to E1 because it would reduce the Palestinian population in East Al-Quds and further diminish faint hopes of any so-called two-state solution. Adala, an Israel-based advocacy group for Arab minority rights, tweeted, "Since the new Israeli government was inaugurated in December 2022, it has taken a series of alarming steps to accelerate its annexation of the West Bank, aiming to fulfill its commitments to increase Jewish settlements and ultimately extend Israeli sovereignty across the West Bank." Adala asserted that the Zionist regime's new annexation moves entrench Jewish supremacy and apartheid in the West Bank by steps including the institutional transfer of authority from military to civilian government offices in order to dismantle the authority of the military administration, assert Israeli state sovereignty, and promote the settlements, the further regularization and expansion of illegal settlements, and the direct application of Israeli domestic law to the occupied West Bank. These are part of an explicit plan by Israel to annex Suaves of the West Bank and institute full Israeli sovereignty over them, Adala asserted, adding, "They violate international law, including the Rome Statute, constituting crimes against humanity, war crimes, and a crime of aggression." The Zionist regime is blatantly violating international law with its annexation of the West Bank. The American government can and should materially pressure the Zionist regime to stop impeding on Palestinian human rights. The U.S. gives the Zionist regime around $3.8 billion in mostly unconditional military aid each year. According to the Middle East Eye, Axios reported recently that the Zionist regime informed the U.S. it plans to build 4,000 housing units in several existing West Bank settlements. The report comes after Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's government shelved plans to expand a settlement east of Al-Quds, which, if constructed, would divide the occupied West Bank into two. The plans for E1 settlement project, which would see 3,412 housing units built for Israeli settlers on occupied Palestinian lands, would connect the Kfar Adumim and Male Adumim settlements with occupied East Al-Quds. The plan would effectively split the West Bank in half, isolating East Al-Quds from Palestinian communities in the West Bank and forcing Palestinians to make even lengthier detours to travel from one place to another, while allowing for settlements housing Israelis to expand. The U.S. and the European Union have long objected to the settlement plan, warning successive Israeli administrations not to move forward with the project. Under the Biden administration, Washington has issued statements in opposition to new Israeli regime settlement plans. In May, a U.S. State Department spokesperson rebuked the Zionist regime's government moves to legitimize the outpost of Homesh in occupied West Bank, originally established on private Palestinian land. The spokesperson claimed in a statement, "This order is inconsistent with both former Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's written commitment to the Bush administration in 2004 and the current Israeli government's commitment to the Biden administration," adding, "Advancing Israeli settlements in the West Bank is an obstacle to the achievement of a two-state solution." Zionist regime has repeatedly ignored U.S. opposition when it comes to settlement expansion, including recently in February when the Zionist regime government announced it would be expanding Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. However, at the same time, Washington has moved to protect the Zionist regime's settlement policy, saying in that same month that it would oppose a resolution that would condemn Israeli settlements at the UN Security Council.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. On June the 5th, 1989, the funeral of Iranian leader Grand Ayatollah Imam Ruhollah Khomeini took place in Tehran. It's estimated that around 10 million people participated in his funeral, the largest number of people ever to attend a funeral procession and also one of the largest gatherings in human history. On today's show, we're going to ask, who was Imam Khomeini? And we're going to examine his immense contribution to Islamic revival. But first, here's a brief overview of his extraordinary life.
June 3, 1989, saw the passing of a titan of modern history, a man who changed the political landscape of the Middle East forever, the founder of a new state on the back of a revolution which toppled the tyrant and upset the West's imperialist stranglehold on the region. Born May 1900, Imam Khomeini would become an influential Muslim cleric and marja, who went on to become the political leader of the 1979 Islamic Revolution of Iran, which overthrew the monarchy headed by Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, the last Shah of Iran. Following the revolution, Iran became an Islamic republic. Imam Khomeini ascended to the post of Grand Leader, the paramount figure in the political system of the new Islamic Republic, until his demise. His successful campaign to topple the Western-backed dictator of Iran wasn't his only great lifetime achievement. He successfully led Iran's defense in a costly invasion by Iraq between 1980 and 1988, implemented a democratic process for Iranians, and set the country on course to full independence from foreign interference. Under Imam Khomeini's leadership, freedom struggles across the region also received huge support, with Lebanon and Palestine specifically benefiting from Iran's help in fighting back against Israel's colonialist project. Perhaps more importantly, Imam Khomeini proved that the religious Islamic system could successfully govern a modern country, opening the doors to a model of political Islam, which inspired Muslims across the Ummah to live by Islam in all areas, not only privately, but in all spheres of daily life. The Islamic Republic has now become a safe haven for Muslims and Islamic practice amid a rising Islamophobic atmosphere gripping the globe. Every year, his passing is mourned by millions of Muslims across the world, his legacy continuing to inspire many more decades after his passing.
Well, joining us today to talk about Imam Khomeini, we have two esteemed guests, Sheikh Ahmed Hanif, a Muslim scholar and lecturer based here in the UK, and Shabir Razvi, a poet, writer, broadcaster, political and economic commentator. Gentlemen, welcome to the show. Sayyid, let me come to you first of all, because you know, you've been to Iran many times, you've seen the impact that the revolution has had on that country and the wider region as well. Just tell me about Imam Khomeini and his legacy and what it's achieved not just for Iran, but for the region in general.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. It's good to be here, especially with the important personality like Sheikh Hanif here with us. Look, I have had the privilege and honor to be at Imam Khomeini's funeral itself. There was a group of people here, youngsters. We were young at that time, getting old and decrepit.
You're young at this time.
At that time, many years ago. So all of a sudden, when we heard that Imam Khomeini had died, literally within 12 hours, we were on the flight from here, about 22 of us with six scholars based in London. And there were two particular incidents which, one can remember. One was the arrival of Imam Khomeini from Paris to Tehran. That was, again, a huge sort of outpouring of people on the streets. I can't remember the numbers, but it was millions who turned up to greet him when he arrived in Tehran. And the second one was this particular time when he died, when he departed from amongst us. 10 million, perhaps even more, were there. And when we arrived there back in 1989, it was just literally, people were crying, the officials at the airport were crying. It was an extraordinary sort of outpouring of the people that really loved an individual of Imam Khomeini's stature. And when one thinks of how did he impact so many people, he wasn't their father, he wasn't their cousin or their uncle or whatever, he was another third person. But people had immense love for him, no matter what the West says and maligns him. But the reality is that the people were in love with him, not just in Iran, but abroad. Youngsters like me who grew up in London, we didn't have any, going to university in the 70s in London, one didn't have a model that one could talk to the world about. Either you had communism or socialist philosophy at the university, and there was no dialogue about Islam. Islam wasn't on the agenda. There wasn't, as you said, in the introduction, that there was no model for world to see. And this is, I think, it's very difficult to talk about the legacy of Imam Khomeini because it's like pouring an ocean of water in a jug. It's so immense that one can't do justice in a half an hour, 45 minutes program.
Of course,
on this particular individual.
We will do our best, certainly. Let me bring in the Sheikh on this because I want to get your view specifically on the religious achievements of Imam Khomeini and also his revolution. Now, as Sayyid Shabir mentioned very accurately, at the time of the revolution, communism was very prominent, and there was this kind of Cold War situation going off between the capitalist West and the communist East. Imam Khomeini came in, changed the face of not only Iran but the region, and I think Islam and political Islam were the biggest benefactors of his activities. Just elaborate for us this point, because I know how important it's been for the Muslim world that Imam Khomeini came to succeed.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Just to sort of piggyback on what the Sayyid was saying, in terms of, the kind of world that existed at the time, the political world that existed at the time, the major struggles were between communism and capitalism. And so you found a kind of a colonialism of ideas, in the sense that the majority of the ideologies used by non-Western countries that used to be called third world countries to fight imperialism, they tended to always use Western types of ideas and models and so forth. Islam up to that point, meaning the point where Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi, came onto the scene, was largely forgotten or placed aside in preference to other, quote-unquote, more meaningful or more rational or more scientific, you hear this word a lot, scientific socialism and so forth, applications of Western ideas. What Imam Khomeini, rahmatullahi, did when he spearheaded this Islamic revolution was the revival of Islamic political thought as a means of counteracting Western imperialism. From my own personal experience, you find that a lot of African Americans and Afro-Caribbean type people, people in the African diaspora, in our fight against indigenized imperialism, you know, they used to call communities like ourselves or the American Indians or the American Native people as a fourth world, meaning the third world within a Western environment. In our confrontation with the totalistic aspect of in interior domination, we as African Americans did not see, when I say African Americans, I mean the Americas, not just the US, did not see socialism or liberalism as sufficient ideologies to fight that, because we were fighting things like cultural imperialism, you know, the domination of Christian ideology and so forth. And so we had people like Malcolm X, for example. You know, we've had experiences of Islam even back in the times of slavery, where the majority of the slave uprisings were carried out by Muslims. We did find in Islam an answer. And for many of us, this became crystallized externally as a reality for us in the Islamic Revolution of Iran, which illustrated to us, especially the appropriateness of Islam as a liberation movement.
Now, Sayyid Shabir, one thing I want to learn more about is Imam Khomeini as a Muslim leader. Basically, what was unique about him from that perspective when he came into the scene? What did he change? Not just the political landscape, but the Muslim landscape. What was different about him?
That really is quite a fascinating question, and really following up from the Sheikh's sort of analysis, is it wasn't just an impact on the political scene. It was an impact on the cultural scene. It was an impact on the social scene. It was an impact on the educational scene. So, you know, it was a wide variety of sort of aspects of society. Say, for example, you know, in London in the 60s and the 70s, you wouldn't see many women wearing scarf. So that was a, not a political, but a religious cultural impact that took place. And, you know, educationally, universities were closed down for 3 years soon after the revolution because they wanted to cleanse the education system of the Western influences that you were referring to, Sheikh. And at a social level, you know, people started to understand what were the Islamic etiquettes to operate in a social environment, so that, you know, whether mixing of the genders was concerned. So really, you know, as I said, one's got to sort of break it down at different levels. And of course, the impact of an individual was so phenomenal that no one could really sort of get away from it. You had to talk about it. Whether you liked the individual or you didn't like it, the conversation had to have. And that has been going on for the last 43 years, and it has continues till this day. So the impact on the Muslim world, as I said, in different areas of human life happened. And not only that, in the West itself, you know, as I said in my earlier comment, those of us who were young and living in London, you know, the families were religious, they would go to the mosque or the Husseiniyas, you know, go for ziyarat and whatever. But really, you know, someone doing those mandatory aspects of religion were not sufficient enough, because it required one to operate as a full human being, to be understanding what the social life is all about, what education we are receiving, does it have Islamic basis to that? And at a cultural level, you know, one can talk and talk that the impact culturally has been just incredible over the last 40 years.
I like the fact that Imam Khomeini made absolutely clear that you can live by Islam, not just in your own private life, but in all aspects of life, political, social, as you mentioned, the revival of the hijab as well. It's almost like he instilled a pride in our Muslim identity, and it should, you know, reflect our identity in all spheres at all times. That's something which I admire very much so. Sheikh, what I want to ask you is about this title of Imam. It's obviously something which he's known by, but not everyone may understand its significance or the meaning behind it. So perhaps you could explain the title of Imam. Why was he referred to as Imam Khomeini rather than by, say, his full name normally, or as a Grand Ayatollah only? What's the significance of the Imam title?
Well, you know, the name Imam has always been in the Muslim world and in Muslim history. Apart from, you know, the usual ritual aspects in terms of the imam of prayer and that type of thing, the name of imam as a political concept has always been in Islamic history. If you look at Islamic history, before even the determination of the word khilafah, you know, as a word to describe or designate the leader of the Muslim ummah, you know, we had the word imam. You know, that preceded this idea. And so Imam Khomeini, in this case, represents a political aspect. But he also reflected in himself a general leadership of Islamic thought, in Islamic thought in the society. So when we're talking about the general the political leadership.
And Sayyid, one thing I want to ask you as well is, you know, he's something, it was like a Shia revolution, leader, political leader, religious leader, and it's Shia Islam that's benefited from it. But that's not actually the case, is it?
Well, absolutely not. I mean, you know, Imam Khomeini himself very clearly pointed out in his speeches, in his writings, and post-revolution very clearly that neither was it an Iranian revolution, nor was it a Shia revolution. Yeah. It was really an awakening. I like the word awakening more than revolution, because it awakened the Muslim masses to understand that, you know, you used the word pride in your earlier conversation. Pride has different meanings. Pride can make one arrogant. But this was pride really to sort of gain the dignity that was being sort of lost by the Muslim Ummah and also the oppressed people. Because the beauty of the revolution was that it wasn't just, as I said, confined to Iranians or to the Shias. It was for the whole oppressed world. And that's why, one of the reasons why from day one that Imam Khomeini supported the Palestinian cause. You know, Palestinians, 99%, 98% are Sunnis. But at the end of the day, you know, the pain that Iran has suffered is because they have supported the Palestinian cause for the last 43 years, if you like. Yeah. So it was supporting the oppressed people. That's why you look at it, why Iran supports Venezuela, why Iran supports Cuba, why Iran supports all the people all over the world. And that again is coming back from the Islamic ethos, because one of the message of Karbala, of Imam Hussein, was to stand up against the oppressor and to support the oppressed. And this was the key phrase, I think, that, and it resonates with anyone. You know, you talk to someone in London or Washington or Paris, they will know who the oppressor is and who the oppressed are. Therefore, it was, you know, the language was also, as I said, you know, I talked about the culture and so the language itself also changed. And I just wanted to make a comment, you know, your commentary in the beginning talked about Middle East and even the geography, the words that we use. It's not Middle East, it's West Asia. It's not Far East, it's Southeast Asia. You know, these are, again, words which we have adopted from the sort of, even at a geographic level, from the colonial mindset, if you like, which the Islamic Revolution...
Eurocentric.
Colonial Eurocentric, if you like. And that, it's in itself, is very important, that how we use the language, the vocabulary, that Imam Khomeini inspired people to understand that words and language have meaning to it, and it has to be used in a way that contextualizes what really is happening in the world.
One thing I want to ask you before I move back to the Sheikh is you mentioned earlier in the show that you remember the time, the revolutionary time, the time when Imam Khomeini returned from Paris and it changed the face of Iran in the region forever. I want to ask you about what you remember the impact was on, say, Muslims here in the UK. So I, for example, might say that that was the start of the British Muslim community when we saw his reaction to like the Salman Rushdie case. He encouraged Muslims and inspired Muslims elsewhere in the world to actually, you know, unite and stand together. So Britain, of course, is there are Muslims from different backgrounds, different countries, different ethnicities, different sects. But it seems as if there was a period after the revolution where Muslims began to engage with one another out on a street level and actually stand up for their beliefs and basically campaign and that type of thing. So just tell me, what impact did Imam Khomeini have on, say, the Muslim community here in the UK at the time? Do you remember?
Yes, I remember it vividly. I was in the demonstration against Salman Rushdie in London at that time when there were, I don't know, some people say half a million Muslims turned up at that time. It was an incredible sort of sighting of Muslims. And they were not Shia Muslims. Obviously, you know, Shias are not a majority in the UK. They're 10-20%. But majority of the individuals were Sunni. And then you had, you know, incredible people at that time like Kalim Siddiqui Mahroom, who was a Sunni, but a real advocate of the Islamic Revolution. Similarly, Brother Bangash in Canada, again another Sunni individual who writes phenomenally and speaks in support of the Islamic Revolution. Ahmed Didar, a South African, again, who visited Iran, and I had the privilege of meeting him when he was in London at that time. So, you know, you've got to look at it, and it was really such a rapid change that occurred in individuals who were, I mean, it gives away my age that, you know, I'm incredibly old to have lived through all that, that it had a huge impact on the generation that was in their 20s or just coming out of university or were at university.
Do you think it brought more people closer to Islam?
I have no doubt it has. Hmm. And that, I think, we are living through in 2023, where Muslims are being, you know, Islamophobia has become a very common place now.
Yes.
And it's, you know, some might say that it's because of the revolution that, you know, people have become Islamophobic. No, that's not the case at all. Sort of the Western ideology has been always against Islam.
I think the Islamic Revolution is a counterbalance to fight back against the rise of Islamophobia, definitely.
Absolutely.
Sheikh, we haven't got a lot of time left. I do apologize, but I will end the show with your comments on this. Just tell me, what do you think in terms of how he's impacted the community in a positive sense? Could you perhaps list some of the positive legacies that we live on from today that Imam Khomeini inspired during his time?
I think one thing that the Imam, first of all, the Imam was fundamentally a cleric, okay? And he was a revolutionary secondarily, okay? And what about his clericism that it affected this transformation? And I think it has a lot to do with, for example, the incorporation of the idea of rationalism, as would be endemic in the Usuli type of school of thought in Shiaism, the ability to look at our history, look at our Islamic sources to find guidance in terms of, fighting that, in terms of also incorporating certain modern ideas, you know, like, for example, ideas of imperialism, for example, you know, and looking at broad solidarity among the different third world peoples, you know, and also people inside Western countries, Muslims inside Western countries, for general common features where we could support, as you would mention, Venezuela, you know, which is basically a Christian country, support Palestine and Lebanon, you know, which are largely majority Sunni countries and so forth. So he revived this idea of pan-Islamism, basically.
Mm, yes.
You know what I mean? So where Muslims could unite. And of course, interestingly enough, the backlash to that would be the creation of a dark Islam, which we would call Wahhabism or Salafism, you know, that really is sort of the straw man that Western policy has created in order to show Islam in barbaric lights and so forth.
Trying to divide Muslims.
Right, which is really where Islamophobia comes from.
That is a very strong point. I wish we had more time to discuss it. Unfortunately, we don't, Sheikh, but I'm sure we'll have you back on the show, as well as you, Sayed Razvi. Thank you so much to everyone for joining us this week. Unfortunately, we are out of time, but we will be back again for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum for now.
The U.S. military may see a second consecutive year of failure to meet its recruitment goals. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. According to Press TV, despite loosening restrictions, adding new incentives, and deploying massive promotional campaigns, various branches of the U.S. military are struggling to enlist new personnel, a sign of not only the declining mental and physical health of Americans, but also growing disdain for American wars. Many have described the failure to meet the military's recruitment goals as a crisis. After all, it was not too long ago when Americans, in a drunken flurry by the post-9/11 war drive, flocked to recruitment centers. The early 2000s saw some of the highest increase in numbers for the military. Fast forward 20 years. In 2022, the U.S. Army missed its recruiting goal by 25%. Some 15,000 troops. In a bid to meet its recruitment numbers, the Army invested $100 million in schools meant to push potential recruitments into qualifying mental and physical shape. This fiscal year, it is on track to cost $119 million, but is in danger of falling short yet again. The U.S. Navy also did not meet its active duty and reserve targets for 2022. It may this year, but barely, and only by severely dampening down the requirements meant to join the Navy, such as a lower passing grade for the Naval Entrance Exam, which has caused concern in Congress. Lastly, the U.S. Air Force is projected to miss its recruitment goal by 10% this year, despite lowering its entrance requirements, much like the Army and Navy. What could be causing the world's biggest military to be facing such an unprecedented crisis, especially now when the United States is potentially preparing for a war against China while seemingly attempting to increase its military presence in West Asia and Africa? It's twofold. Firstly, there is the physical condition. Americans are simply declining in health. In a memo released last year by the Army Chief of Staff, just 23% of 17 to 24-year-olds Americans are qualified to serve. poor food quality, lack of quality physical education, and the glamorization of sedentary lifestyles. Video games, streaming have disrupted the health of millions. Doctors have even gone as far as to call it a public health crisis. But even more importantly, do Americans being eyed for recruitment agree with the wars engineered by the U.S. military-industrial complex? The prime recruit for the military, an 18-year-old male, would have been born in 2005 in the starting years of the U.S. illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq, all while conducting brutal acts of terror in Afghanistan. When they were just getting started in school, NATO's illegal bombings of Libya started. By the time they reached high school, the U.S. was already in Syria without invitation. An entire existence surrounded by war. And what does America have to show for it? In Iraq and Syria, the U.S. started a power vacuum that led to the rise of Daesh terrorist group. Libya's destruction turned it into a slave market. The U.S. fled Afghanistan, giving all of its weaponry and bases to the very group it had spent 2 decades, the longest war in U.S. history, fighting the Taliban. Now, the U.S. is poking its main global rivals, China and Russia. Any sensible young and informed American would have to ask, is it really worth it?